Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, this is Stuart Acuff with Utility Workers Union of America, asking you to tune in every time you can to Bob Carson's Carson's Corner, one of the best pro-labor shows in America. We love it at Utility Workers. We love it across the AFL-CIO, and we're grateful to Bob for coming on and holding up our issues and holding up our principles and values.
I'm Andrew Craig. I'm an investigative reporter and attorney based in Washington, and I'm the author of Presidential Puppetry, Obama, Romney, and Their Masters. And I want to encourage everyone to support, listen to, and talk about the Carson's Corner show in New Jersey, which is a pioneering, courageous, and apt voice for progressives in New Jersey that I first came to know in 2009, when he was the pioneering and virtually unique media outlet willing to take on Chris Christie, dig deep, and look at how he had come to power and how he was misusing it. And 4 years, 5 years later here, that's all come to pass.
Hi, this is David K. Johnston, and you're listening to Carson's Corner with Bob Carson.
This is Les Leopold, the author of How to Make $1 Million an Hour, and I just want to tell you that you'll get a rich and rewarding experience by listening to Carson's Corner.
This is Greg Palast, reporter for BBC Television and Democracy Now, and author of the new book Vultures Picnic, In Pursuit of Petroleum Pigs, Power Pirates, and High Finance Carnivores, and you're listening to Carson's Corner on 5:30 a.m. Underground Progressive Radio, radio for the 99%. Help us occupy the airwaves and support Carson's Corner and support 5:30 Underground Progressive Radio.
Hey, this is Frank Schaefer, author, writer, New York Times bestseller. But I'm here today because I've got a new book called Why I'm an Atheist Who Believes in God. And I'm also on Carson's Corner because corporate media is so one-dimensional in terms of the kind of things they cover that they couldn't comprehend a discussion that would begin with a statement that implies a huge paradox. But I think there's a lot of thinking people out there who understand that life is paradoxical, and Carson's Corner is one of those places you can discuss it. So thanks for being with us.
the white wall. Walk a seat back, the brakes in the gate. Pull without a fate. One moon and no hope, pull without a fate. Walk a seat back, the brakes in the gate. Pull without a fate. One moon and no hope, pull without a fate.
Of Carson's Corner on Blog Talk Radio and in conjunction with the CommonsProjectNetwork.com. My name is Bob Carson. We're pleased to be with you this Wednesday evening. And that was, of course, Rage Against the Machine with Out of Face. And, you know, I got to tell you, I love that song because the verse of that song, the bass line, it's so depressing. You know, it's like I think Rage Against the Machine captures the realism of despair. It captures the reality of capitalism, and it's just, you know, you feel there's a real kinship that you feel when you listen to that song, a real solidarity that you feel with other individuals that are experiencing economic hardships, which pretty much amounts to a vast majority of Americans. Okay, it's true. Most Americans are really suffering under this current economic system, and that's what's so great about listening to Rage Against the Machine. I think that we should make a particular Rage Against the Machine song, and this could be debated, our national anthem. You know, that's what we have to really focus on. We really have to gear the nation towards accepting a Rage Against the Machine song as our national anthem. We can have it, you know, we'll debate the song. They're all very important songs. Okay, these guys, let me tell you something. These guys have been around for years talking about these issues. And, you know, what we say here on Carson's Corner and every issue that I speak about, every fact, statistic, fill in the blank that I say on the show during the course of this hour, it is, you know, we're not reinventing the wheel here. This is building on the work of individuals that I reference as much as I possibly can. People like Noam Chomsky, people like Ralph Nader, who's got a new book out, people like Tom Hart. I mean, just fill in the blank. A lot of people that, you know, have been speaking about these issues probably longer than I've been alive. And it's all a culmination of the great body of literature that's out there, material online and other places, so that you and I can learn. And, you know, knowledge is power, okay? Knowledge is power. The only thing that's going to free us is us becoming aware, us reaching more people about what is going on in this country and where we're headed and why we're headed there and who's responsible for it. I'm thinking about doing some lectures now. You know, my brother and I went to a community college the other day, and he gave a lecture. I helped out with the presentation. But, you know, I'm thinking to myself, I could easily do this. I would be great at just taking Carson's Corner and the issues that we discuss on this show to an audience and a live audience and spreading the word that way. It's a great way to do it. I mean, some of the people that are on the Commons Project Network are more active than I am. But, you know, that's no excuse. I should start to get more active, and that's something I'm looking at to really – because there's just not enough people that are being exposed to a progressive point of view. Now, if you poll the American public and you know, issue by issue, you'll see that we're not a libertarian country. We're not the ownership in the media, the opinion reflected in the ownership – in the media is not that of the American people. The American people love socialism. They just don't know it. They love a progressive taxation system. They just don't know it. There's just a corporate wall that exists between what people love and what they can actually receive from their government. And it's difficult, but we have to try to reach these people, because I was having a discussion today with a coworker who's younger than me and describes himself as a libertarian, and libertarianism is really popular among some young individuals. There's just no question about that. Ayn Rand and Milton Friedman and some of the work out there resonates with individuals that are younger, okay? And I think there's a lot of reasons for that. But, essentially, we were agreeing on a lot of core issues and a lot of breakdowns in our society and why they are occurring. It's just that there's just an ideological divide between us. But, nonetheless, there is a lot of agreement. That really represents what's in Ralph Nader's new book. And I'll probably be picking it up sometime this week. But anyway, I want to have a discussion. We sort of had a discussion about this on our last show, in part after Frank Schaefer appeared, about dog whistle politics, because I think it's very, very important, because dog whistle politics, as written by Ian Haney Lopez and documented. And if you get a chance to listen to Ian Haney Lopez and his interview with Bill Moyers back around February of this year, I'll tell you, he's a great public speaker. He's a very clear, concise speaker that really makes a lot of points when he talks. And these are points that we must address. We talk about on this show quite often the welfare queen myth, the food stamps president, right? We heard President Obama in 2012 as the food stamps president. And in America, there exists such agitation when it comes to food stamps. Now, food stamps account for less than 10% of our budget each year, okay? It's not $80 billion a year. Is not a lot of money when you look at the federal budget as a whole. You look at the amount of waste and inefficiency that really is the cornerstone of our marketplace, particularly in the defense industry. Trillions of dollars missing in the Pentagon budget. Billions of dollars wasted on useless missile defense programs, useless fighter programs, fighter jet programs, where there's no risk of a foreign country invading us, and yet billions and trillions of dollars goes into this this area of the budget, and yet it's not questioned. It's not into the arena of debate because of the corporate ownership in America. General Electric, Westinghouse, both of these companies rely on defense contractors to make their profits, and they have both extensive ties within the Obama administration. Like we say here on Carson's Corner, it's very difficult to tell where government begins and the private sector ends and vice versa, and that is by design. And so when we get a discussion, we have to focus on welfare, because welfare has been racialized. We have white America that is steeped in the idea that the government is only serving the interests of Black America, okay, minorities. This is empirically proven. You look at the Tea Party, poll after poll says that the Tea Party believes that too much has been made of the problem of race in America. And if you poll the Tea Party, you'll find that an overwhelming majority of these people, if not majority, relative to the general public, believe that too much has been made of the problems facing Black Americans. You know, the white Americans are the ones being discriminated against. And this is reinforced by popular talk show hosts like Glenn Beck, who, you know, not too long ago says he felt like we're in the civil rights era movement, only the races have been reversed. And this is the idea. And so when you hear something like a welfare queen or food stamps president or, you know, even president or Mitt Romney, the 2012 Republican challenger, talk about how he lost because Obama wanted to give away free stuff and people can't, you know, take personal responsibility for themselves. That is steeped in racism. That is essentially dog whistle politics because, as Ian Haney Lopez points out, on the one level it seems race neutral, right? But yet, on the other hand, as you know, Lee Atwater so eloquently said years ago, you're not going to win elections by using the N-word. You're not going to win elections by blatantly racial provocations, okay, as Ronald Reagan did when he spoke about the young buck, you know, at the supermarket buying a T-bone steak with, you know, food stamps. He got a lot of flack, so then it became, you know, tax cuts. Tax cuts are a way to defund the government. Tax cuts are a way to essentially punish minorities out there. And that is to this day, it still resonates with millions and millions and millions of Americans. Keep in mind, the Republican Party gets their support by appealing to white voters. And so Ian Haney Lopez, and I've asked the question on the show many times, how is it that such a message that Mitt Romney carried, and people like Paul Ryan and others, which says that, you know, 50% of Americans or 47% of Americans can't take responsibility, they look to the government for answers, they consider themselves victims. Paul Ryan saying 30% of Americans don't believe in the American dream. How is it that that can resonate with white America over and over and over again to the point now where, you know, 98% of the leadership in the Republican Party is white, okay, and the electoral base consists of almost all white voters? And the answer is the racial appeals in that messaging. It has been 50 years of dog whistle politics that has really affected the political landscape. And, you know, you could go back to even when George Wallace ran. You know, George Wallace, according to some accounts, wasn't all that racially hostile, okay? This is a guy who was on the board, the Tuskegee you know, air flight, the air unit, the African-American unit that, you know, flew during World War II and really was instrumental in battling the Germans. He was on the board that, you know, initiated this group, I believe. And he, you know, was not racially conscious or at least as explicit as he was after he ran and said that in his next political race, he's not going to be out N-word. And that's where, you know, you had these just shrill racial provocations that culminated in the Southern Strategy. And this was used by Richard Nixon. You can go back to, you know, Richard Nixon stopping the, you know, desegregation of schools and forced busing and you know, all these different things And it has not gone away, and it is used to activate voters. It's used to win votes, because that's what politicians have to do. They have to win votes to keep power, okay? And you know, this still exists today, and it's really unfortunate, because if the American people only looked at welfare for what it is, which is, you know, an indirect or direct subsidy to, you know, an individual business, right? This is really how Ralph Nader defines it. Then we really start to have a fair discussion about the amount of corporate welfare that exists and how that is affecting the United States government. Let me give you a statistic here. And you know, this is, you know, you could consider this a form of welfare. I do. I consider the United States tax code one giant payoff, a junket to the very wealthy. But corporations, going back 50 or 60 years ago, were paying about 30 to 40% less in taxes. Now the corporate tax rate in America is something like 10 or 11%. We have the lowest effective tax rate, which is the taxes actually paid by corporations in America or in the world. I think we're right up there with Mexico, or right down there with Mexico. Okay, now this has had a tremendous effect on our society, and we just can't emphasize this enough. If you have corporations that are paying less taxes, which we are, if you have corporations, groups like ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, literally writing our tax law, right? And you know, you have the help of both parties, Chuck Schumer, instrumental in the capital gains tax, you know, it not being raised on his constituency, which is Wall Street. And Chuck Schumer is a Democrat. He's a very, very powerful Democrat. Okay, you have President Obama, who, you know, changed his tune on corporate taxes, is essentially as conservative as Mitt Romney is on the corporate tax issue, wants to lower taxes on corporations that are paying already next to nothing in taxes. And what happens is these corporations run roughshod over our government and over us as a people. They use our commons. You know, they clog up our court system. We have 70% of court cases that are just almost exclusively taking place to protect corporate assets. And we have these corporations, again, you know, shipping jobs overseas because our tax code incentivizes them to do so. And what emerges out of this is a society in which we have ourselves in right now, where the corporate profits are through the roof. There's a huge amount of wealth accruing at the very, very top of the income ladder. Corporations like Walmart and others have more economic power than most countries on the face of this earth. And we're told that we're broke. We have a problem with spending. And therefore, we must cut spending. We must structurally adjust our society, which amounts to a class assault. And President Obama has done nothing but cut spending over the past 3 or 4 years. It was President Obama that created the model for austerity. Okay? You know, understand that when you go after, you know, folks like Paul Ryan and others who, you know, would privatize Social Security, privatize everything they can get their hands on, have us being ruled by private economic power. Understand that President Obama essentially endorses that position. He agrees with that position that we need to cut the federal budget. We need to cut food stamps, as the Democrats have done such agitation over food stamps in America. And you know, raising taxes on corporations is not in the question. Going back to the Reagan tax cuts, the Reagan tax rates which were 70% when Reagan came in, it doesn't enter into the equation. It's not up for discussion. And so what happens is you have a society that becomes even more and more and more unequal, and the balance of power shifts more and more and more towards the wealthy, to the point now where we are almost a corporate state now, where we're just totally moving towards a complete corporate state, and we're losing our rights. We're losing our privilege in society. We're losing everything as a result of the corporatocracy of America, not the functions of government. You know, this individual I was talking to today at work, he was agreeing with me, and then he turns around and says, "Well, we have too many regulations on business, right? We have this is the problem. Of course, we always hear this talking point: too much regulations, right? So the answer is to give more power to corporations, to eliminate the regulations. First of all, that's not true." Okay, Dr. Robert Rice talks about the marketplace, how governments do not intrude on markets. Governments maintain and create markets. And it's absolutely true. No businessman would be wealthy if it wasn't for the United States government. No investor would want to invest in the company if it wasn't for the United States government. These companies would not exist. They would not have the technology that they have right now if it wasn't for the United States government. And these are important points because they just illustrate the idiocy of this argument. But this is an argument that benefits the ownership class. It's an argument that we will always hear because we don't have a discussion in America about business, about the relationship between business and labor, and the inherent flaws in our law, in many laws pertaining to workers, pertaining to business owners, it's pertaining to everything. I mean, the more and more and more you look at our system, the more and more and more you realize that everything is just inherently flawed. And a wise man once said, and this is in the Zeitgeist films, it's no measure of proficiency, I'm paraphrasing, to be profoundly adjusted to a sick society. And so the way I look at it is, if you're a businessman in this culture, if you're very wealthy in this culture, you've only been able to do so by being, almost anti-life, almost anti-worker, and that, again, that speaks volumes about our system, how the system in America, and this is very, very important, the system in America is designed to maintain consumption. It's designed to maintain consumption. It's called cyclical consumption, where a person earns a paycheck, they get their money through either a wage or a salary, they buy things from a store, and then that money winds up in the employer's pockets, and the employer, it keeps the economy going. It's money changing hands. It's the movement of money. It's basic sales throughout our economy. And in order for this to continue, it's important that things break down. It's important that, what you have depreciates the moment you own it, because we have to maintain scarcity in this capitalist economy. And so what emerges out of this is a war on efficiency, a war on abundance, a war on science to, maintain scarcity. And as a result, there's just not enough to go around for everybody. And these are very, very important concepts, because this is what creates class division among us, okay? And so, our economy, every area of our economy, the healthcare industry, right? This is a big point here, but it all relates to, you know, our economy. It all relates to government spending, right? It all relates to austerity. These issues are interconnected. So you have a healthcare system in America, which is the most wasteful and inefficient system in the world. The United States of America is ranked something like 37th by the World Health Organization. We suck. Yes, this country sucks. We suck, okay? Let's not be afraid to say this. Let's not be afraid to say that America sucks, okay? I'm not. I'll say it to anybody. You get anybody in front of me, any one of these Tea Party, you know, nut job, gun-toting individuals out there, some of these veterans that come home and you see, you know, the videos online of them ripping flags and intimidating, you know, anybody that would question America and suggest this country sucks, which it does in so many ways, I'll say it to their face, I don't care. What are you going to do? What do you want to do? You want to attack me for speaking the truth? Go ahead. That's fine. I'm tough. Pinko the Bear's tough. We survive capitalism every day. It drains the life out of you. But, you know, we're 37th in health outcomes. And yet our healthcare industry is siphoning one out of every $6 we're spending. Okay? So how is it that, you know, we have the worst healthcare outcomes out there? Okay, we have the highest rate of uninsured, although that's going down because of this Obamacare, which we all agree it doesn't do anything to address the real problem within our healthcare industry, which is the private for-profit markets being at the helm of everything. Why is it that we continue to spend more money in this field, and why is it that these companies, these healthcare companies, which I think should be illegal, why is it that they continue to profit even though they're doing a shitty job? You know, they continue to make money. Their stock continues to go up. Nobody talks about this, but it's true. Over the last 10 years, you know, even during the healthcare debate, nobody mentioned that the stock of these corporations and the pay of their CEOs and the amount of money that they make continues to go up even though they're doing a horrible job. Well, that is because these health insurance companies are highly consolidated. They don't have to compete. They rely on government subsidies, because you could look at Medicare as a government subsidy, which I do. Medicare is essentially subsidizing the private for-profit market, because it's insuring old people, and old people are not profitable for insurance companies to insure. And so, you know, that's what we have now. And there's no end in sight. And you know, any type of regulation that exists in the Affordable Care Act that we would regard as good for society is subject to the next election. And so, you know, at the end of the day, we still have a broken healthcare system that will remain broken unless we address the real problem, which is the private for-profit insurance market, which is giving the private bureaucracy power, making them the death panel, not the government. You know, a system based on abundance does not have a death panel in it, okay? And you know, you hear the made-up horror stories, oh, look at Cuba and ration health care and this and that. You know, Cuba and other countries that are used as, you know, the old Soviet Union, they're used as ways to distract us and beat us into submission, into accepting the current, system that we have here in America. They're not true socialist systems. They're not based on abundance. They're controlled by a few elite groups, and they don't represent, you know, socialism, true socialism. An example of socialism can be considered Medicare, or can be considered veterans care, which I understand there's a big scandal now involving the Obama administration with regards to the Veterans Administration, or the public highway system, or the public rail system, or the police departments, the fire departments, the military. You know, these entities, these areas of our economy will provide service at virtually no overhead, very, very low overhead, particularly Medicare, Social Security. You know, anybody can use these services, and you don't have to be a millionaire. You don't have to have money. They're there to serve the general welfare of the public, and they're efficient, and people love them. That's why I say that Americans are socialists, only they don't even realize it. Okay, and it's a very, very important point. But you know, we just continue to move on the wrong path. Okay, and going back to Ian Haney Lopez's book, Dog Whistle Politics, and how, you know, it's not going away. This is one of the things that Ian Haney Lopez discusses. The dog whistle politics, the use of race to get people to act, to get people to support an agenda that is the opposite of what benefits them. Tax cuts for the very wealthy, deregulation, all the things that we've spoken about here on Carson's Corner, right? This is how it's done. It's all done by race. And this is not going away anytime soon. There's a school of thought out there that says that because the demographics are evening out, because by some estimates in 2050, the white race will be 49%, okay? And this is cause for celebration because the Republican Party can no longer rely on white voters. They can no longer rely on, you know, 98% of the representation that they offer individuals to be white individuals, male or female, okay? And so, you know, there are people out there now, and I've even said it before that, you know, I'm happy that we have changing demographics in America. I'm happy that we have, you know, seemingly an awakening happening across America with the fast food strikes and, you know, the election of a socialist. You know, we can argue whether or not she really is a socialist or she can be effective in you know, in our current system, right, the way our election system and our economic system runs, or Bill de Blasio, you know, not that he's revealed himself to be a progressive, but, you know, these are all glimmers of hope. But there's a reality of the situation is, which is that no matter what happens, okay, there's always going to be use of dog whistle politics because 50% of Hispanics identify themselves as white. And if you look at areas in the country like Miami and other areas, there's a huge right-wing outreach to Hispanics to get them to identify with whites and therefore, you know, accept an agenda that is basically adversarial to their needs, because we know that, you know, as a whole, the Hispanic community appreciates the role of government in our lives. They don't subscribe to the idea that we must limit government as a by proxy way to punish minorities, as the Tea Party does. And so the point of all this, and, you know, the Democrats have essentially embraced this message as well. This is another important point, and this is something that you're not going to see on the corporate media, because the corporate media, whether you watch MSNBC or Fox News, not that there's an equivalency there, but they have to give you, quote, both sides and you know, both sides, this and that. Well, what they won't tell you is that Bill Clinton has essentially embraced this message. You know, it was Bill Clinton that ran on a campaign of ending welfare as we know it, and we all know welfare is associated with African Americans. It was Bill Clinton that talked about how tough on crime he was, and nobody can accuse him of being tough on crime, and he purposely slighted Jesse Jackson. And this is what happens. And so the Democratic Party, which I think essentially takes minorities and labor for granted, has turned their back on African Americans. And you can look at President Obama, you can look at his speech on many speeches, his Philadelphia speech on race. I think even before he became president, his reaction to the Skip Gates controversy, his defunding of Acorn, firing of Shirley Sherrod, his emphasis when speaking to the black community on personal responsibility and choices, and the Brothers Keeper initiative, which is a disaster, sponsored by the Kellogg organization, to Wall Street and going to Wall Street and laughing at the notion that people call him a socialist. All of these different things, basically point to the fact that President Obama has turned his back on, a core constituency. And so it's unfortunate, but the Democratic Party has moved closer and closer and closer to, what the Republican Party used to look like, prior to the days of the Civil Rights passage. And that should be noted. It really should be. Because if we acknowledge that, if we agree with Noam Chomsky in the sense that both parties are, two factions of the business party, one party that's outright fascist, another party that's approaching, fascism, arguably, and it gives the American people less of a choice. With that said, we're going to go to my friend Justin Ray Harvey has called in. Very excited about this. It's been a long time since we had Justin on the show, and I want to find out what he's doing. I haven't spoken to him, and I want to get an idea for what he's doing, because Justin is a real courageous individual that I'm a personal friend with. And I've known Justin for about 5 years now, and he's one of the bravest people that I know, and he's really inspiring. Justin, welcome back to Carson's Corner.
Glad to be here, Bob. How's it going tonight, brother?
Very good. Glad that you were able to call. Just give people an update on what you've got going on.
Well, here lately, I have just been really working very, very hard on the Justin Harvey Show and working very, very hard on my social networks. And now my YouTube channel, where my show can be heard, has over 200 and some subscribers. And I'm in the process of even finding a part-time job even.
So. You know, Justin, you mentioned that to me last week, I believe it was, and I was just so excited, because that really is just very, very brave of you, and it's inherent upon you, because you do want to get out there, you do want to be active, and your disability makes it very, very hard for you to do that. So it's extra hard for Justin Ray Harvey to go out in the workplace than it would be anybody else who doesn't have a disability. And the fact that you acknowledge that, the fact that you want to get out there, I think really is a testament to the American spirit.
Oh, absolutely, Bob. And I wanted to say, too, Bob, if you can hear some squeaking in the background, that's my dog playing with her toy. I do apologize about that.
I heard that. That's what I figured, too. But, this goes back to what I was saying earlier about dog whistle politics, and how we're supposed to believe that certain cultures in America are inferior, right? When we hear things about race, we hear stereotypical arguments being made, which are designed to cast minorities as inferior. Blacks are lazy. right? Immigrants, they breed crime, and this becomes the common sense of race. And I think it's the exact opposite. I think that individuals inherently are not lazy. Individuals inherently want to work hard, and this is illustrated by the amount of hours that Americans work. Americans almost have no time off. They have less vacation time than their Chinese workers' counterparts. And still, you know, we're being told by leading presidential candidates, someone like Chris Christie, where we become a welfare nation. And, you know, it's been decided in the business community that we have to attack welfare because people are too lazy. And I think Justin Ray Harvey proves that is the exception, that is not a rule. Here we have somebody who has a disability, which most people can't handle the idea of going through what Justin has gone through in his life and inherently wanting to work, when it would be easier for him, I know I could speak for this, it would be easier for him just to stay home and not work, you know? Just like for some people, it is easier for them to do that, but the reality is that, you know, your drive and your determination requires you to get out there and to work, and that is representative of the American people, not the stereotypes depicted by the elites in our society.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, and it's like I see these stereotypes all the time, Bob. Like, people automatically think if you're physically disabled, you can't work or you can't do it, you can't do this and that, and obviously that's not the case. You just have to find a way to work around your ailment or your disability.
Well, absolutely, and you know that's the disabled in our society, I think, have been marginalized. I think they have been used, and it's unfortunate. It is, because, you know, everything depreciates in our society, and the moment you become disabled and you can no longer work for an employer that can control your labor and make a profit off of your labor, then, you know, in America, if you don't work, you don't survive. If you don't make money, then you don't survive. And you're not going to make money unless you can make money for somebody else. And this goes to the capitalist system in America. Mm-hmm. And I think that's very, very bad. And, you know, I want to see a society where everybody is equally as valuable. I want to see a society where we have the resources to go around and to take care of the basic needs that we all have. And this, I'll relate this to you and your situation, Justin, how, you know, your condition requires you to get wheelchairs. Your condition requires you to get medical equipment, okay? Now, you need these equipments, this, you know, you need all this to survive, okay? You need all this to continue your life. But yet we don't give it to you on the basis that it costs too much money. And you know, we withhold equipment in order to make sure that equipment is valuable so the owner of that equipment can make a profit. And this all goes back to what, you know, what we're saying, how, you know, people are stereotyped, people are marginalized, but it's because of the very system. It's because of the very capitalist system that breeds these outcomes.
Exactly, because, like I was telling you, my insurance will only pay for one wheelchair every 5 years, so I needed a manual and power chair. So what I did was I'm ending up paying for the manual chair, and then I'm letting the insurance pay for the power chair, because buying a power chair is like buying a brand new damn car. So.
And what would, if we were in another country, I mean, if we were in Canada, or if we were in some of the European Union countries, what would be the outcome? Well, I can guarantee you that, you know, you wouldn't have to spend, you know, $10,000, whatever the amount is, for something that you need to survive. And it goes to, you know, the very system that we speak about, where Justin Ray Harvey's needs are secondary to the movement of money. You know, the life sequence is secondary to the money sequence, the movement of money. And that is a system that we tolerate. And why? My question to the audience, and my question to you, Justin, is why do we tolerate a system like this? Why do we tolerate a system that says that, you know, if you're disabled, you're not going to get the care that you need? Why do we tolerate a system that says that if you're homeless, you're not going to get the home that you need? It doesn't make any sense. It's anti-human.
Well, here's my response, and this has become a big part of the human condition, Bob. It's the easy way out. People have become lazy, and they just want money, and it's just the human condition these days. It's the easy way out.
Well, I'll tell you, I think that we become lazy in our thought processes. You know, I think that it's easier to watch, you know, a football game or a baseball game than it is to pick up a book and read that. But work-wise, as I was talking about, you know, Americans, you have to work to survive in this country, and that's what we say. You know, if you don't work to survive, then you ultimately will have to succumb to the forces of nature. If you don't eat, then there's a biological process that will take place in your body that requires you to do whatever you can to eat. If you don't have shelter, there's a natural process that occurs through weather to make sure that you get shelter no matter what you have to do, even if you have to go, you know, pitch a tent in the woods. There are these different forces of nature that force us to work and basically keep us contained in this system. The problem is that, once you get home from work, once you get home from renting yourself out to an employer for survival, you're inundated with the constant stream of carefully crafted, you know, corporate propaganda designed to, as Malcolm X said, get you to loathe the oppressed and identify with the oppressors. And that's a blatant paraphrase, but what Malcolm X was saying was that, I posted this on Facebook the other day, if you're not careful, you'll let the newspapers convince you that the poor and downtrodden are the enemies and your captors are the individuals that you should bow down to. And it's true. It's the power of corporate media convincing people that the opposite is true.
Hey, and Bob, just to switch gears for a second, I wanted to share with your audience real quick. One of the proudest moments in my radio career that I ever had was a few months ago. I interviewed Sarah McMahon, and I asked her thoughts on disabled people, you know, fighting in the cage, and she was very supportive of it. As a matter of fact, she said, if I ever fight in the cage, she'd come and watch me fight.
Yeah, I mean, Sarah's a really good person. We'd like to try to get her on the MMA show. It's very, very important. All of these issues are. It's where do we go from here? It's how much is it going to have to get worse in order for us to really reject the system? You've got the 2014 election coming up, and who cares? And then you've got the 2016 election coming up, and who cares? Are any of these politicians going to be elected to change things? No. They're elected to keep things the same. And so whether it's Hillary Clinton or Jeb Bush, we're going to continue to live in an America where the business interests are the only thing that matters. The amount of money that you have constitutes your quality of life. And the amount of money that you can potentially make is influenced by factors beyond your control. The fundamentals of our economy are not changing, have not changed, and don't look anywhere on the horizon of changing. And you know, it's really what's happening is it's getting worse and worse and worse. The privatization of our economy, the internet is under attack, the workers' rights, to whatever extent we have workers' rights in America, to whatever extent we have unionization in America, that's under attack. That'll be gone because we're moving towards a fascist corporate state. The regulations, the idea of businesses being regulated by government, that I predict is going to go out the wayside because right now we have a corporate civil rights movement, which is using the courts to give corporations more and more and more rights and us less rights. We have a system where, you know, the minimum wage, there's a push to raise the minimum wage. Well, guess what? I mean, you know, it's still not even close to making through Congress. And what is just as likely to pass as that most likely is a repeal of the minimum wage. Basically, in America, abolishing the federal minimum wage and allowing American workers to work for $2 or $3 an hour. That is where we're going in America. It's happening fast. It's happening right before our eyes. And it's only going to get worse before it gets better. And the question is, what is it going to make? How is it going to get better? Well, you know, we need a social force, as Elon Musk says, to challenge capitalism. Okay, that's we have to challenge capitalism, the fundamentals, the assumptions within this system, and then, you know, hopefully we can start to change the fundamentals of the economy. But I'll tell you, we're not there yet, Justin.
No, we're not. And like I said in the past show, Bob, what we need to do is we need to put someone like you or me in the White House that's not rich and that's not corrupted by these politics here, and see what kind of positive change that person can make.
You know, that's an interesting, very interesting point, Justin, because Alan Moss responds to that. He is the author of the book, The Case for Socialism, and it's really, really a great book. There's a foreword in there by Howard Zinn, and, you know, he makes the case that even if you have somebody, even if, let's say, I get elected or you get elected, the institutions of government are designed to preserve itself. They are designed to preserve the status quo. And the institutions that are outside of government, the you know, special interests, the vested interests, want to keep things the way they are, the Federal Reserve, the defense industry, you know, the 10,000 or so, whatever, political action committees and the lobbyists, the 60-some-odd thousand lobbyists swarming Washington, D.C. like cockroaches, they would put undue amount of pressure on anybody that resists the current system. And therefore, our hopes, I don't think our hopes lie with a politician. Our hopes lie with a mass movement of individuals that have the ability to stop the current system and stop companies from making a profit and demand rights and not to be moderate. You know, Frederick Douglass and others, you know, talked about there's no progress without struggle. And we're seeing this right now. But one thing we have to realize is we cannot be moderate. We cannot say, oh, we just have to work and compromise. And, you know, that's not how you get things done. You get things done by, you know, having a mass movement of people that are committed to changing the fundamentals of the economy and organizing around the money that has organized them around them and maintaining power. And it's hard, The Russian Revolution had happened for 10 years. The workers took control of that country for 10 years. But then after that, the pressure from the West and others, you know, collapsed that socialist movement. But that's what we need. All right, we've got 60 seconds left, Justin. Give people your Facebook page and any other relevant information out there.
Okay, you can find me on Facebook and Twitter at Justin Ray Harvey. And you can email me at justinrayharvey@me.com.
Sounds good. Justin, thanks a lot for calling in. My name is Bob Carson. You can like us on the Facebook page at facebook.com/Carson's Corner 13. Friend me on Facebook at facebook.com/Bob Carson MMA. And just a reminder, next week I'll be at the John Jay Left Forum Convention with Pinko the Bear and others, and hopefully we'll be doing a live episode of Carson's Corner from there where we can interview many of the event speakers. It's very, very important, so we'll keep you posted on that. Until next time, ladies and gentlemen, show some respect. So long, Justin. Talk to you later.
So long, Bob.